welcome to another episode of the Chad Prather Show. I'm excited about this one. I want you to hang in here with me because we're going to change your life guaranteed once again. Powerful, powerful stuff. As you know, every now and then we are capable of kind of telling you some things that make you go, wow, that's impressive. That's powerful. That's really something that meant something to me. And I think this episode is going to do that for you. I want to encourage you, go where podcasts are offered, subscribe, that way you get the notifications every week. And I'll tell you another thing you could do, go to YouTube if you want to watch these videos, and not only subscribe to my Chad Prather page on YouTube, but hit the little notification bell. That way whenever a new episode comes out, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, you're like, wow, that's a lot. Well, you should be sitting in this hot Studio 22 running your mouth all day long. Trust me, it is a lot, but you're worth it, and you're welcome. Because we're just here for you. Over in the peanut gallery, lovely wife, Jade.
Hello.
With her Keep MAGA Ritas great.
I'm a Ritas fan.
You are.
Ow, ow. I need one
right now. You...
Keep your hands to yourself, party foul Steve. Oh, he's making you feel the love. You just totally touched my wife's breast.
I just groped Jade on camera, I think.
On camera, totally.
Can we edit that hand out?
No, it's there for posterity's sake. Our kids are going to appreciate that, yeah. Hot news Natalie over there.
Howdy.
Hey, watch out, Natalie. Steve's handsy.
I know. Here they come. It's awkward.
See how Steve tried to play that off like it was an accident.
Hey, her husband's way bigger than you.
I know, trust me. But I signed your paycheck, so.
Sometimes Jade does, so.
That's true.
That is true. We got the puppet master, Mark, sitting in the director's seat over here taking Hello. Care of business. Candice, queen of the Ecuadorians. Do you like being Ecuadorian or Ethiopian?
Ethiopia
is fun because that's the biblical reference.
Yeah, let's stick with that one.
Yeah, so people, okay. Because, yeah.
Yeah.
I wish you had not revealed what race you are. You could have continued to be a race to be named later.
I should have kept that card.
Exactly. I love it. Candice, queen of the Ethiopian, she made the decision. Sitting in the hot seat today. Chad Robichaux, I'm excited to have you on here. You flew in from Prescott, Arizona. You're always on the road. You made the sacrifice to come in here. Chad is the author of An Unfair Advantage. This is his book right here. Look at him. Look how handsome right here. Wow. Yeah. Golly.
Looking good today. I was a little dusty that day.
Oh, yeah. Where were you on this rooftop? This Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Look at you. Yeah. Golly. Over there doing business. We're going to talk about it. How you doing, man?
I'm doing really well.
Good. Yeah. Force Recon Marine.
That's right.
Special Operations, MMA champion, mm-hmm. police officer, former police officer.
That's right. Yeah.
Motivational. What have you not done? Because people have said, so who's Chad Robichaux? I said, Chad Robichaux is coming on the show. I'm real excited about it. A couple of people said, now who's Chad Robichaux? And I said, oh, you got to watch this. This is good stuff. Because my wife, I told her yesterday, I said, I'm proud of you, babe. You've accomplished so much here recently with doing different things she's had going on. And she said, Chad Robichaux is the one you should be proud of.
There's a lot of things I hadn't done, like rest it. So, yeah.
So let's get into this thing. I want you to go all the way back. And you got a powerful video that's out with the I Am Second group.
Yeah.
And the book is amazing. We're going to talk about the book. But I want you to take me all the way back to where it first began for you, because this has been a journey, and I'm going to mostly try to get out of the way and let you tell this story.
Well, I mean, for me, I can't really start from Afghanistan because my family is a 3-generation Marine Corps family, and one of the things I was just telling you, something I'm super proud of, my son Hunter is in Afghanistan 2 days now as a 3rd-generation Marine, but it really started with my father. You know, he was a Marine Corps infantryman in Vietnam. And he came home, and like many of the warriors we serve at our foundation, at Mighty Oaks Foundation, my dad suffered with a lot of things after combat, and he didn't get the help he needed. So my family and I grew up in a very dysfunctional home with an angry guy, lots of alcohol, and lots of physical abuse, particularly me and my brother. And my brother and I were 13 and 14 when we decided, hey, we're going to escape this lifestyle. We're going to join the military when we can. And so we started really preparing ourselves to do that. Running and swimming at a very young age, 13 and 14 years old. About a year into that, my brother was shot and killed. And so it was extremely devastating to me at that time because he was the closest person to me in my life. You know, siblings in a dysfunctional home get really close.
Sure.
And so I went into like a really deep depression and isolation. What I had of a family really fell apart. And but I kept that focus to join the military. And when I was 17 years old, I met a Marine Corps recruiter named Staff Sergeant Brown. And I'm always be thankful for that opportunity because it gave me a second chance at life, started with a clean slate again. And I always wanted to be in some type of special operations because growing up in Southern Louisiana, I loved the water, loved to swim. And I wanted to, something about being, you know, in the military, being in the water, getting to swim and do those types of things were appealing to me. And so my first year in the Marine Corps, I tried out to be a reconnaissance Marine. And at a very young age, I made it. And the time in the military is a lot different than now. And so I did a lot of schools, a lot of training, but no wars, you know, going on. Yeah. So I actually shifted from active duty to the reserves to go to college. And I went to 3rd Force Recon Company, which was the reserve reconnaissance unit. And I was going to college. That's when I was a police officer in New Orleans. And it was, you know, during that time when I remember those planes. We were just talking, hearing you talking about it earlier, when those planes flew in those World Trade Center buildings. I was sitting with my wife watching on television, and I knew, you know, my life was going to be different moving forward.
Yeah.
I think everyone in the military did, and people weren't showing up at their commands like, oh my gosh, we're going to war. Everyone was like, hey, what's up? Like, when are we going to do this? And the military was motivated, and I wanted to deploy. And I got the opportunity to join what's called a JSOC, Joint Special Operations Command Task Force, and I got exactly what I wanted. I got to deploy eight rapid deployments over a four-year period.
Eight times in Afghanistan, eight different deployments.
Yeah.
But you, when you were a police officer in New Orleans, I know, because I've heard your story, you had an episode that happened where there was a domestic dispute, domestic violence call, you came in, and there's a family there.
Yeah.
Walk through that story a little bit, because I think that was, because I'm taking you somewhere on this thing, and I want people to realize a couple of issues that I want to talk about. But let's start there.
Yeah, well, I was very young, you know, had 4 years of active duty in the Marine Corps in the reserves, so I had some life experience, but I was, for a police officer, I was pretty young. And I remember getting a call going over the radio, and the guy who responded to the call was a guy named Steve, and he was very seasoned. I respected him, looked up to him. And so when I heard his voice over the radio kind of stressed, I knew something was wrong. And he was at responding to a domestic violence call. And New Orleans had just got this brand new radio system. And of course, in this moment of crisis, it went down. And so couldn't communicate with him. So I just rushed there. And when I got to where Steve was, it was kind of elevated modular home, standing on a porch and arguing with this lady. And there was about 30 people outside, right off this porch, kind of observing what was going on. And made my way through those people, got on the porch, and Steve told me, hey, get rid of this lady. Her husband's inside. And he just barricaded himself with a gun in the back room. And so I kind of held that doorway, and the woman could start trying to get inside, ended up throwing her over the rail. She kind of flipped over the rail, and people grabbed her. And then Steve went to the window where the guy had barricaded himself. And while I was standing in the doorway, I was kind of in the living room and looking across, and catacorner across was a hallway. And there was a mirror in the hallway, and I remember seeing the guy. The guy's name was Russell Stebbins, and I knew him. I'd dealt with him before. He's a very big guy. In fact, I know now he was 6'3", 263 pounds. Hmm. And, you know, at that time, I was probably 130 pounds. I was, you know, been training martial arts, but I was not a very big guy. And so I'm looking across, and I can see him in this mirror. And as he's standing there, he has a rifle, and he's messing with the chamber like he's press checking it to make sure it's loaded or not. And I mean, you know, as I'm looking across this living room, this is a home. This is like, there's toys on the floor, family pictures, his wife screaming outside. His two kids are right there with his mom. And so I just started yelling at him, you know, not to come out. And when he did turn the corner, he had the rifle over his shoulder. Not like he would be holding it to shoot someone, but he had it over his shoulder. But his finger was right by the trigger well. And so, you know, by use of force policy, I had very clearly could have shot him at that moment. But I just felt like still in control. I was trying to talk him down. And I'm like, hey, put down your gun. He's telling me to put down my gun and to leave. And that he wants to get to his wife. And so we got in this verbal altercation. And I actually started just telling him, hey, I'm going to kill you. Like, instead of like police commands, I'm like, I'm going to kill you. And he kept coming towards me. And so I made a decision, instead of to shoot him, to try to disarm him. And I rushed towards him and kind of retained my pistol close to my side, grabbed his rifle and pushed it away from my partner and I. And because I knew my partner was behind me, I couldn't see him, but I knew he was behind me. And when I pushed the rifle away, I kicked him in the balls to try to yank his gun away from him. And the second time I kicked him, because his gun wasn't coming away, the second time I kicked him, he grabbed my wrist hand. And so now we're both fighting over two guns with this guy that's much bigger than me. And I knew at the moment, like, he wasn't going to back down.
Yeah.
And so I kind of turned my wrist in him to break his grip. And I shot, and I ended up shooting six times. My partner shot over my shoulder six times. So we shot 12 times total, and we hit him 11 times. I remember he turned, and as he turned, he kind of fell on his knees, and he looked back just conversationally to me, and he just said, "You killed me." And pushed him down and pulled the rifle out from under them and handcuffed him. somehow one of his arms must have been in the way because his like wrist kind of blew out, and I remember it was like really like a noodle.
Mm-hmm.
And I had blood, like some, I had short sleeves on. I don't know how, but I had blood like all over my arms. And you know, one of the, my most vivid memories of that is just his wife, you know, hearing his wife screaming and people trying to hold her back, his wife trying to get to him. And of course, at that moment, all the police, all the rest of the police showed up, and my partner and I were separated, and went through a very long process of going through a grand jury, having to go before a grand jury for an indictment for second-degree murder because of testimony that we might have executed him. Some of the people said, because I assume people heard the shots, looked in the window, and they saw him on his knees and us standing over him.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the autopsy and forensics showed differently, and we were cleared from the grand jury, and both of us were awarded from Louisiana, from the governor's. We were awarded the Medal of Valor, and shortly after that's, you know, when 9/11 happened. And
yeah, but after that event, because you probably going into that situation didn't think if I kill somebody, it's really going to affect me in a bad way or in a negative way. What were your emotions when you came out of that situation? And then ultimately, because you were married at the time,
right?
And then you know, you got to go home and tell your wife,
yeah,
what just went down.
Yeah, I think most, especially young guys in the military, young police officers, they think like, I have to do something like that. It's almost like you fired up to have to, you know, use what you trained to do. And
and
so if you'd asked me that morning if I would have, you know, if I would have had any issue shooting this guy, I would have absolutely not, you know, it's going to do what I have to do. And you do, right? You do what you're supposed to do, but you wouldn't think it would affect you the way it did. And I remember just being so angry, really, at that guy, like for him making me do this. And I just remember being just extremely angry. And it was a moment in my life, and you know, there's been many times since, but it was a moment in my life where I actually realized kind of the permanence of ending someone's life. You know, it just felt like, wow, that guy is, he's dead. He's not here anymore. And I've seen people die before, but as a police officer, you see people dead in car accidents, but to take someone's life like that, it really impacted me. And I went home that night, and my wife, I remember trying to talk to her about it, and I woke her up, because, you know, no one had called her, and I woke her up and told her what happened, and she just went back to sleep. And I remember being like really angry at her and bitter towards her, because I wanted someone to talk to that night. And, you know, I'm thankful now, knowing my wife. I was just talking to one of my friends about this, like how my wife is just so naive to things like that, because that wouldn't have been the first incident. And you go fast forward to Afghanistan. My wife was able to handle Afghanistan because she's a little naive to some of the realities of some of these things. Our son right now in Afghanistan, you know, it's affecting me a lot more than her, because she's just kind of innocent.
Well, you've been there.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what's there.
Yeah, so she was, you know, she was naive to what I was actually facing and dealing with. But I look back now, and I'm thankful for that.
Yeah. So 9/11 happens. You've been a Marine. Mm-hmm. You've been a police officer. And now you make the decision, you're going to go back in.
Yes.
Yeah. And you went, so when you went back in, what was the goal? What were you wanting to do?
I mean, I wanted to go to Afghanistan and participate at the highest level possible. And so
kill bad guys.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, at that time when I went in, as most guys would have wanted to deploy in retaliation for 9/11, sense of patriotism to right those wrongs that were done to our nation. My mindset changed, and I'll tell you that once I got there. But to answer your question, I wanted to deploy at the highest level possible. So being a Force Recon Marine, I had an opportunity to deploy with 3rd Force Recon Company, augmenting 2nd Force Recon. I had that opportunity to deploy, but I was given this chance to try out for this JSOC Task Force, and I did, and I was selected. Mm-hmm. I probably wasn't the most qualified, but somehow I got selected for it, and I'm super grateful for the opportunity to, when you're at that Tier 1 JSOC level, that's the highest level you can go in the special operations community.
Yeah.
And so to have that opportunity was like really, I recognized it, and I was really excited to do my job. And when I got to Afghanistan, you know, I thought, you know, I had the best training, the best team, the best equipment, the best support. I would have thought I was completely prepared, just like the morning before that shooting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is what I want to do. I'm completely prepared. But, you know, looking back now, I was not prepared to do the job and to witness and participate in the things that I did, you know, over those deployments.
So you go on a deployment, you come home, you go back on a deployment, you come home, you go back on. This is eight deployments you're doing this. Where were you more comfortable? Deployed or at home?
Deployed, yeah. I mean, I felt very disconnected, like back here. I mean, when I went to Afghanistan the first time, again, like I said, I had a very unique experience. I didn't live on a base. I lived in town. I'd work with, you know, this small a group of guys. Usually we work in like two of us embedded with local nationals, other Afghans. And so my experience there was like a day-to-day basis. I wouldn't go in a base and then come out and do an operation. I lived with these people. And really quickly, talk about my sense of patriotism. Like, it shifted from that to really helping these people. Mm-hmm. I ate dinner with their families. I played soccer with their kids. I heard, and I started hearing the stories of who the Taliban was and the oppression that these people were under and what the Taliban had done to them. And then I started to see it. And I began to hate the Taliban. I mean, and everyone on my task force felt that same way. It's like kind of this very Viking, very violent, intense culture towards the enemy. And particularly the Afghans, like the Afghans that we worked with, the former Northern Alliance guys, those guys hated the Taliban and they were so driven and passionate. And that's how we operated. And it worked mm-hmm. really well in Afghanistan. But then I come home and I just felt like that personality, that intensity to the anger, I just felt very disconnected. Like my wife and children were terrified of me. I mean, they would say something, you know, and that would just set me off and I'd throw temper tantrums like a 15-year-old child. I'd scream at them and break things and punch things and throw things. I mean, this was like immediate behavior shift for me to behave this way. And I recognized it, but instead of trying to rectify that behavior, I just started regressing back. Mm-hmm. Probably one of the moments I remember most is that really kind of opened my eyes to how I was being and made me pull back was my daughter's birthday party. My daughter's like extremely opinionated and she was really excited I was home for her birthday and the fact she had moved it for me to make it home from Afghanistan, but she didn't like the icing on her cake and she like made it known. And I like just flipped out and just grabbed a handful of my little girl's birthday cake and threw it against the wall and destroyed my little girl's birthday. And I remember thinking like, you know, who does like something like that? Like who does, what kind of dad does things like this to their, yeah.
For very different reasons.
Right.
You know, I was in reading and watching your story and kind of getting to know you without getting to know you. I'm watching this and I'm like, here's a guy that I you know, because I'm very open about my dealings over the years with anxiety and depression and mm-hmm. anger stuff and things that for the most, because I grew up in a home with a father who he had grown up in an abusive home and he didn't know any other way to discipline.
Right.
He loved us, but he was very hard, you know? Mm-hmm. So I watched his short fuse temper and it's what I knew. And I always swore I was never going to let my kids see what I saw in those things. And you know what? They saw exactly that. They saw all those things, you know, smashed guitar, you know, things thrown through the wall, fists thrown through the wall and stuff like that. And so I was reading this story and I'm like, it wasn't because of what you had been, right. But it's like, you know, you feel like, what kind of monster am I?
Yeah.
That has done that. And we had Mike Ritland on, who was Navy SEAL. He trained, you know, dogs for, you know, explosives and IEDs, you know, and he now has a kennel in Cooper, Texas, where they basically are retiring these SEAL dogs.
Right.
And letting them come home. And this is in no way to condescend, because we're talking about dogs, but these dogs are warriors and they don't know how to turn it off. Mm. And people think, well, that makes sense. That's what they were trained to do. But it's like, what about the human mind, which is much more complex? And you've seen what you've seen, done what you've done, experienced these things. You've got a warrior mentality. Now you got to come home and be normal.
Right.
And whatever normal is.
There's not a switch that you can just flip.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and just what you said, like I said, I always said, like, I learned how to be a father from seeing my dad,
right.
And I'm not going to behave that way. And now I'm recognizing that I'm doing the exact same things.
Yeah.
I hadn't progressed to the physical abuse to them, but they were definitely, my family was definitely abused by me.
Yeah.
And when I recognized that, instead of making those corrective, you know, things, yeah. I just backed off. And it was much easier to be in Afghanistan. And my wife was like, she's amazing. She's like, we're talking about deployment wives. Like, I never had to worry about like my kids or anything. Like, she was just on top of it. So I was like, okay, well, I'm content. You could do that. We could do this family thing later. Like, I have a job to do right now. And I was very focused and it made me successful at my job. And you know, when you're successful at something, you get more and more opportunity.
Yeah.
And so I pressed harder and then, you know, I'm continuing to deploy over and over. And when I was not deployed, I was back home going to schools, training, like we were preparing for the next deployment.
I'll tell you, so there's something that I've gotten really passionate about here in recent days, and that is, and it's, we've seen it in the headlines in recent days, you know, we had three veterans kill themselves in VAs over a period of 5 days in Texas and Georgia here recently, and the VA is a mess. We've got people who are suffering with, you know, my good buddy, Marine Jeff Kyle, Chris Kyle's brother, you know, he calls it PTS because he doesn't like the D. He says it's not a disorder. It's something that happens when you go through these things. But we've thrown around terms like PTSD, and we know the atrocities and just the – and I say atrocities, and I mean it. Mm-hmm. Just the VA has been a mess. And yeah. I tell people, I said, don't call the VA, because all the VA is going to say is, well, we had to waste manpower and hours taking phone calls, and we couldn't get to people to treat them. It's already a nightmare. Call the politicians and call them every day and tell them this has got, something's got to be done. But I appreciate you because you're out on the front lines doing something about this, because you came home, and let's continue that story. Mm-hmm. You came home with PTSD, severe right. case of it. At the time, did you even realize what that was?
No, I didn't. You know, I was in this very small, like, special operations community, and people just didn't talk about stuff like that. People talked about guys going crazy, like, but that was not PTSD. And so when he's... physiological symptoms start to manifest from like anger to anxiety. It was started with like my arms would go numb, my face would go numb. I'd feel like my throat was swelling shut, like I couldn't breathe. Sometimes I feel like I had like 1,000-pound weight on my chest. But I knew if I said something, especially in a unit I was in, guys would think I was weak. And so I didn't. I just tried to push it down and do my job. And it worked for a little while, but those things started to get worse and worse. And then I started having these moments where I couldn't remember things. Mm-hmm. And then things start really bad happening on my deployment. I had 10 Afghans that worked for me, and they were killed. And when I, you know, most people would think like, well, they weren't Marines, they're Afghans. Like, these are my brothers. Like, these guys would have died for me. I would have died for them. These were people that I lived with for 3 years. I was very close to them. And when that happened, I took a lot of personal responsibility for that. Some of the other things started happening. It made me feel like kind of imminent sense of doom. Yeah. In fact, I would start writing, not like in case goodbye notes, but I was like writing notes, like knowing, you know, to my wife, to all my, each of my children, leaving my lid in my suitcase because I knew I'd make it home, go out and, on an operation, come back, throw those away because I didn't want anybody to find them. That was a very imminent state of doom for me. And those things progressed. And eventually I got to a point to where I went on this operation for about 2 weeks, and I came out of like this fog and realized that I pretty much wasn't mentally present. And I had put myself in danger, and I also put other people in danger as well.
Yeah.
And when I realized that, that was a moment where I actually had to speak up and say something. And I was brought home, and I was put before a psychologist and diagnosed with PTSD. And, you know, like, I agree with Jeff, you know, like, this isn't a disorder. A body responds. I'm a Christian. I believe I was created. So my body responds in the way it was created to respond to trauma. Right. We need to do the things that we're doing as warriors, but we wouldn't create it to see and witness and participate in the things that we have to do as warriors. And so our body has a very natural way that it responds to that in order to protect itself again. If we don't understand that, then it could feel like a disorder. It could feel like something's wrong.
Yeah.
And we
Well, it's a disorder in the sense that your body, you weren't that way, and now you are that way, and you're like, I want to go back to being... Again, normal, whatever the hell normal is. So,
And the path to normal is the disconnect that many people don't know how to get to that path to normal. And when I came home, I didn't know how to get to that path to normal. And so I did the same thing many people do, is to try to find something to numb those symptoms.
Uh-huh.
You know, some people climb into a bottle of alcohol. Some people do drugs, or some people take the prescription medications and just numb themselves. And we got guys that come to our program on 40 plus pills a day for PTSD only. Prescribed by the VA or by the military. You're not going to get well that way.
And I want to talk about that just real quick. We're going to talk more about it, but I know how it is. People are listening to podcasts or watching podcasts. So before you check out, I want everybody to check out Mighty Oaks. This is Chad's program here. It's an incredible thing. You can go to mightyoaksprogram.org, mightyoaksprogram.org. And
with the S, programs.
What's that?
With the S, programs.
Programs with an S. That's right, Mighty Oaks. Oaks with an S and programs with an S .org. Those are
The programs are free. So any warrior listening, veteran, active duty, spouse, our programs are totally free.
Yeah. So set that up. See if we can get that in there. Puppet master. I don't know. These paperbacks don't always want to cooperate. But you know what? I got a cell phone. I can prop it. Chad Robichaud. You're not the only guy who knows how to operate around here.
It's a Chad thing.
C squared, baby. So you came home, you had to figure out an outlet, a place to put all of this crazy, wild energy that was going on in your brain. And what'd you do?
Well, my wife and my counselor tried to find something, and I'd say I did martial arts since I was little, but I'm still little. So I started.
He's like pocket size. Yeah. Just don't try to put him in your pocket. He'll kill you.
You ever see that old trunk monkey thing? Yeah. My buddies used to call me the trunk monkey. So.
Oh, my God. I would never call you anything but sir.
Yeah, so I was already fighting. Sure. I had done martial arts my whole life, and I was already a professional fighter, MMA fighter. I was doing it on the side. And so they convinced me to get on his mats. And when I got on his wrestling mats for the first time, honestly, I felt like I found a cure because, yeah, you know, doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu, wrestling, you can't think about Afghanistan or anything else. You have to focus on what you're doing in that moment or you're going to get strangled, right? You have to pay attention. Yeah. So my mind was really engaged, and I thought, man, if I could just do this 24/7, like, I'll be good. And that's exactly what I did. I opened a school. I started fighting professionally again. And on the surface, everything would have looked perfect. I mean, if you looked at my life on the outside, you would have thought I was totally fine. Like, my school took off. I ended up with 1,000 students. And at the time, it was pretty much the biggest Brazilian jiu-jitsu school in the country. And I started being successful fighting. I made it to 18-2 as a professional. I fought, you know, Showtime, MTV, that was the main event of Bellator and Strikeforce. And I won a world title belt, Legacy FC title belt. And so, you know, everything looks like it's doing well, but at the same time, my family's still falling apart. I'm still having panic attacks. I'm still a mess.
And throw some of those pictures up, Candace. I want to, of him in the ring and stuff like that, because this is a dude you don't mess with, all right? I mean, this is, like, I'm amazed that you were able to turn it off enough just to not pop somebody's head off. You know, I mean, I'm going to kill this dude.
It's funny you say that, though, but in those moments, in those fights, I felt the most grounded. Like, that brung me down the most, like training, doing jiu-jitsu, because, you know, I believe you have to be composed to do well. And so it forced me to bring a composure on myself, and it was helping me be grounded. It was when I was outside of that I was going sideways. And also, what's dangerous about it is it created a lack of accountability in my life, because as I'm winning fights and doing well, people are starting to come around and kind of lift me up and support me. And, you know, anybody with that kind of status, your status, right? People are going to kind of
tell you. Amazing status, really, when you look at me. I mean, look at my wife. My wife has mastered the art of the eye roll.
These environments, though, create a world that you don't have any accountability. People tell you what you want to hear and not what you need to hear. And I needed to hear some hard things. I needed to get well, and I didn't. And, my life was a mess. My children were still walking around in eggshells and around me. I was my sons, I was their friend and their coach, but I wasn't being the dad that they needed. And my daughter was starting to disconnect from me. My wife and I's marriage was falling apart. I'd spend many nights in my gym or at a friend's house or in my kid's bedroom. And I always say the loneliest place I've ever been is not being away in Afghanistan, but like in my own bed with my wife with our backs turned to each other. And it's dead marriage. And that's what we both just felt like our marriage was over. And so I ended up walking outside of my relationship with my wife and really betrayed my wife and children into an affair and didn't really even care. I had like no empathy at that time. And I remember sitting my wife and children down, and we were saying we're getting divorced and telling our kids it's going to be better. And our kids were devastated. But we sold our home. We filed for divorce. We signed two separate 12-month leases. And my wife and I had two totally different reactions at that moment. And really is what brought us to where we are now. Because my wife, she stayed in the fight. She actually went into a church. And I always ask her, and still to this day, I love hearing her speak and talk about this, because she would say that she just started praying for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, like, at that time, how could she pray for someone that was betraying her this way? She said she would just pray, like, God, let me see Chad the way you see Chad. Let me love Chad the way you love Chad. Let me forgive Chad the way you forgave Chad. And that's what she was doing for me. And while I was doing this to her, betraying them that way. And she'd go to church, not just on Sundays, but like every day of the week. And people would tell me stories of her like sitting there trying to pray for me and just collapsing, crying. And, meanwhile, I'm in this bachelor pad. It didn't take me long to like pimp my apartment out, because I was like going to move away from this wife that didn't understand. And
it was party
all
time.
These things. Yeah, it kind of was like party time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it really was. That was my mentality. It's shameful to say, but that was my mentality. In fact, somebody was asking me recently, and it just reminds me of like how sad that situation was and how shameful it is to look back. But in my apartment that I like fixed up, I didn't have any family pictures up. I put all my family pictures in my closet, because girls would come over and stuff. And so like, I just think like how disgusting that was for me to be doing that. And I fought in this big fight, actually in Toyota Center in Houston, Strikeforce was on Showtime. And everyone was like, kind of the focus on that fight, like really helped me be grounded during the separation. But when that fight was over, I remember going back to my apartment and alone, and just feeling completely alone. Mm-hmm. And in that time, I kind of reflected on where I was, the people I hurt. And before I blamed everyone else, like everyone's an idiot. And it's true. Like there's a lot of idiots out there, right? But I was the common denominator.
Yes,
right?
Indeed.
There is, right? Your show wouldn't exist if they weren't idiots.
Could be taken so many ways, but I appreciate every one of them.
That's funny. Gives you good content, but. Yeah. But I was the idiot, right? I was the common denominator. Like, I blamed my father. I blamed people in the military. I blamed my wife for never understanding. And I was like, it was me. Like, I was the problem. Yeah. And so I came to this, like, conclusion, and this thought came over me, like, if I was the problem, my family would be sad without me, but they would be better off. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that hopeless thought finds a home in the hearts of 20-plus veterans every day, every single day, and three in the VA centers, that last week. And I remember I would go in my closet and I took those family pictures off the shelves where I had them and I put them on the floor and I'd look at them and I was trying to build up the courage. I had my Glock 22 pistol and I put it in my head and my mouth and go back and forth and trying to build up the courage to do this. And then I had this this vision of my son, Hunter, the one that's in Afghanistan right now. He had the only key to my apartment and I just envisioned him finding me, being the one that found me. Mm. And so that really delayed me. But I was still doing this almost daily for like 2 weeks. I wasn't coming out of my apartment. And my wife, Kathy, unwittingly saved my life. She knocked on my door. I don't know why I did this, but when she knocked on the door, probably shame, I hid the pistol. Not like she was going to go in my closet, but I hid it under a blanket. And I answered the door, and we got in this argument. And during that argument, she asked me a question that just radically changed my life. And she asked me how I could do everything that I did in Marine Corps, become a recon Marine, these deployments, these school. I go to these crazy schools that with high fail rates and pass them. And I mean, deployments in itself, she'd watch me do all these things that take an extreme amount of discipline and dedication to do. And then the fighting, right? I cut like 35 pounds for looking like a Holocaust victim, like sucked in bones, like making weight, the discipline it takes to make weight for these fights. And she's like, how could you do all of that? And when it comes to our family, you'll quit. Mm. And that question for me, like, just hit me right in the soul. Like, it's probably no more soul cutting word to me than to be called the quitter.
One of the hardest things a friend of mine ever told me, and he told me years ago, he said, you know, the closest to the audible voice of the Holy Spirit you'll ever hear mm-hmm. in your life as a husband is going to sound just like your wife.
Yeah.
And I said, dude, shut up. Shut up. And never let my wife hear you say those words.
Sure, she knew exactly
what
that meant, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and she was right, too. Like, I had been successful at professional things. I'm proud of being a recon Marine. I'm proud of being a Marine and getting to serve my country in Afghanistan. I'm very proud of those things, of the achievements I had as an athlete. But when it came to the most important things, being a husband, being a father, being a young 17-year-old kid that Staff Sergeant Brown gave a second chance to and raised my hand and said, I'm going to do something important with my life. I quit on all those things, including my own will to live. And I needed to be told that, and I needed to make a decision to change things. And I did in that moment. I didn't know how, but one thing I did know is that I couldn't do it by myself, and I couldn't do it with this people that I had surrounded myself by, because not any fault to any of those people that were in my life at the time, but I had pushed accountability out of my life, and I needed someone that could help hold me accountable to this. And so I asked my wife, was there someone at this church she was going to that could help hold me accountable to this decision? And she introduced me to a man named Steve Toth, who's actually Texas state legislator now. Mm-hmm. At the time, he was an elder at our church, and Steve stepped in my life and took me under his wing, and things began to change from there. It started at we met at a Starbucks coffee shop, and Steve had, first of all, Steve never served in the military. He wasn't an MMA fighter. He was just a small business owner at the time, mm-hmm. elder at our church, but he had the perfect gift to help me. Like, he has ADD, like really bad. And I mean, like, if we leave a restaurant to eat, he runs to his car because walking is like a waste of time. And that's just his personality. The reason it was such a gift for me, because I was so manipulative at the time. One, I probably was manipulative by nature, but two, the government spent a lot of money to train me to be manipulative. So yeah. I knew exactly how to say all the right things.
Yeah.
And I actually had written a 5-paragraph order, which is a military operational plan, like how to fix my life. And it was really good. I was like super proud of it. And I met him and I slid it over to him, and he didn't even read it. He slid it back over to me and told me I was going to fail. I remember being like really ticked, because I wanted him to show it to my wife to win some points.
You want
to
feel how hard I can punch?
Yeah. So I felt, I was like, who's this jerk? Like, how rude. You know, he didn't even read it. And he tapped on that paper and he said, this doesn't have anything to do with your relationship with God. I'm not going to let you waste my time, and I'm not going to waste yours.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I needed to hear in that moment. You know,
we've had a lot of people on the show, and it's kind of been a big thing for me, because I've been there, and there's always that temptation to go there again. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're men. You know, and people hear this and they say, oh, yeah, okay, well, he got accountability and he found God and he did all this stuff. And yeah, his life's perfect now.
Yeah.
Come on, folks.
No.
That's never anything that we're saying. And we've all got that testimony where, hey, it's still a journey. We're still tempted. And I get tempted to get there sometimes. But I always say, you can't rise above accountability. And every time somebody gets up on a pedestal, God has this funny way of just slapping them off. and says, set up another one, slap them off. Set up another one, slap them off. Because if you're standing up there on that pedestal all by yourself, you're not made to not exist in a community. You're supposed to be in that community that keeps you accountable and keeps you faithful. And you guys are sitting over here quiet. I know y'all are listening to this story. It's a powerful story. And there's even more to it, I know. But you guys have questions, Natalie, Jade, Steve. Steve, you awake?
You're awake. Listening.
I was actually, you were talking about still being a journey, how today you deal with the PTS, but I figured that was probably still coming. We're only halfway through the testimony, right? Then what happened? That's like the only thing I want to ask, and then what?
Yeah.
It's so good.
There's a big then what. I mean, when Steve asked me that question, it was like, the only way to answer it was like the truth that I had tried everything else. I had tried the pills. I'd been on medicated, and the pills, I didn't like them. They didn't help me. They made me feel worse, actually. I've tried the counseling. The counseling didn't work. I tried the MMA and jiu-jitsu, like sports and activities. Those things were fun and rewarding in some ways and numb my situation, but they didn't change anything in my life. So it was time for me to try something different. It's one of the sayings we have at our foundation at Mighty Oaks is, if what you're doing isn't working, then why not try something different?
Yeah.
And so I gave this guy, Steve, a chance, and I made a decision to give my life to Christ. And I didn't even really understand what that meant, but it was followed by about a year of mentorship by this guy, Steve, really teaching me biblical manhood and how to make the different choices every day. And what I discovered through that was something that may seem simple to a lot of people, but it was really profound to me. I really discovered that the incidents in my past, my childhood, Afghanistan, losing my best friend, Foster Harrington, that I served with for 10 years. I remember when he got killed, and we were served together for 10 years. We were so close. Like when he got killed, how angry I was. And like all these things that had happened to me, those things didn't lead me to be in that closet with a pistol in my hand. What led me there were the choices I made in response to those things. And I had never lost the ability to choose differently. And again, it may sound cliche and silly, but to me, it was like, I realized I didn't have to let my past define my future anymore. And I could choose differently moving forward. And I knew I needed that accountability. To answer your question, like, I don't trust myself because I know myself too well to trust myself.
Exactly.
I always have accountability. I will never be in my life again in that position without accountability. I live in a very unique place at our foundation. We have so many amazing people around me, and we have a very high level of transparency in our relationships with some of the leadership at Mighty Oaks. And it really keeps me accountable. If I'm struggling with something, I can go right to people. I mean, just like right now, I would be dishonest if I wouldn't tell you that I'm not struggling with my son being in Afghanistan. Sure. I've been there 8 times. I serve people every day that are struggling with the hardships of Afghanistan. I see people come back with missing limbs and not have their friends come back and stuff like that. So yeah, I'm struggling, but the difference now is how I respond to that struggle is much different because one, I understand, I understand God at a sovereign level, I understand who he is, who he created me to be, his hand in all of this. And I also have put the right people around me that when I struggle, I have to go to it. I'm not internalizing it, letting it fester and build up and letting it send me kind of off the rails, which it did in the past. I mean, I look at my life before I had accountability and it was like a train heading for a brick wall without brakes. Mm-hmm. Like eventually there was a crash into something and it did. And so understanding that differently, it just really dictates how I live my life now and moving forward. And ultimately, when I realized these things and through this mentorship of Steve, I also realized I wasn't alone. Like when I was going through this, I felt like I was the only one. Like no one could feel the way I feel. No one could be so hopeless in their marriage or so hopeless in their life to where they feel like there's no purpose moving forward. They don't want to take their life. Like I realized I wasn't the only one. And, finding restoration, finding hope, finding purpose again. And one of my favorite quotes is Mark Twain, 2 most important days in a person's life, the day that they're born and the day they find out why. Mm-hmm. Like I felt like I discovered why I was here. And it was to share what I had discovered because I wasn't the only one. 22 guys were taking a life every day. The divorce rates on places like Camp Pelham were over 80%. Like, and now I was given a solution to this problem and I didn't want to keep it to myself. I felt obligated to share it. And so when we started Mighty Oaks, it wasn't like, hey, let's start Mighty Oaks because it'd be a great job to, and it'd be a great idea to start a nonprofit. We were in no way equipped to do it, had no idea how to do it. It was probably a terrible idea for me and Kathy to start at that time in our life because we were still bleeding ourselves. But we just felt obligated to do it because we felt like, again, we had the solution. And one of the things with the veteran nonprofit world right now, and it's 43,000 veteran service organizations that are nonprofits in America right now. And a lot of them are great. Most all of them are well-intended. But if you look at many of them, they're talking about the problem. And that really, I really recognized that even at that time. Everyone's talking about the problem. Everyone's talking about veteran suicide and PTSD, but no one's proposing a solution. And so we wanted to bring the solution to the table and we felt like we had it and we have. And you talk about purpose, like that's been my life mission ever since, my wife and I. And we've just been, you know, felt a fire underneath us to share this purpose with other people. And not just bring hope and healing to other people, but then equip them to do the same thing.
Yeah. And what do you see, ratio-wise, what do you see in terms of men with PTS versus women with PTS that are coming back? I mean, do you see a big difference in how they're handling that and dealing with that? Is it more men, I would assume?
Well, of course, because it's more men in the military.
Right.
But on a, you know, on a one-to-one ratio, women are statistically more likely to have post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
Based on trauma. And, you know, I think it's like 33%. I could be off a little bit. 33% more likely for women to have post-traumatic stress from the same incident than a man would. And so, yeah, women are more prone, or definitely more prone to having adverse effects to trauma. However, we have much more men in the military. And so there's more men to serve. We have our programs. We run 31-week programs a year. Of those 30, this year, 26 of them were for men. 4 of them were for women. Mm-hmm. Not because we don't like women. You know, most of our staff are all guys, and they all love women. But the reason why
I want to make about Trump and who can and cannot be in the military right now.
Yeah, we don't have those programs.
We're not doing any reassignments at Mighty Oaks.
We have 2 gender programs. They have option A and option B to pick. But
well, there's 27,000 genders. Anyway, okay.
Yeah. So I mean, we respond to the demand, and so the demand that we have on our programs are, you know, favor more men than women.
Yeah.
And so 26 of our programs of the 30 have been male programs a year.
Do you feel like one of the sexes deal with the post-traumatic stress better than the other one overall, or everyone's just real different?
I think everyone's individually different. Everyone's experience is different. Everyone responds to trauma differently. And we, you know, based off of our history, a predisposition based off of childhood experiences, particularly when, you know, most of the guys that we see go to combat, they come to our program. And when they get to the point in our program where you start talking about trauma, these guys have had like horrific deployments, and you think they're going to start like, you know, when I was on Jalalabad Road, and no, they start when I was 7, when I was 9, mm-hmm. That's where we're here. There it starts. So, you know, I do believe, you know, the experiences guys have in Afghanistan, Iraq, definitely contribute to a diagnosis of PTSD, but most of the time there's a predisposition to it based off of life experience. And I think that's where resiliency comes in. And one of the other things we do besides run these programs for Mighty Oaks is we do resiliency training. So I go on bases around the world. I just got back from Germany while I was speaking to Marine Forces Europe and Africa there. Last weekend I was at Marine Corps boot camp. 4 mm-hmm. years now the Marine Corps lets me go to Marine Corps boot camp and talk to these recruits the very beginning of their service and tell them about how to be resilient warriors, how to be the continuum of resiliency is mind, body, spirit, social, how to be mentally tough, physically tough, socially networked, and what spirituality means and how important it is. Spirituality is someone's spirituality is to their resiliency, to be combat ready warriors and to be resilient warriors, able to bounce back from the things that they're going to do. Mm-hmm. And so resiliency is so important on the front end. And I'm very thankful to the leaders. You know, a lot of people, you know, most military guys, what they do is complain. I mean, it's part of being in the military, and I complain a lot.
Part of being a man, in some way.
Well, and that's why I asked.
Yeah.
Because I'll tell patients, I work in a pediatric office, and I'll tell some of my patients that are 9, 10, 11, 12, hey, you have a phone, because mom is not only thinking about herself, she's thinking about you, your brother, and your dad. Yeah. You know, a lot of times I feel like, and it's not that men don't do that, but I think overall, sometimes we're thinking about everyone's life mm-hmm. plus our own. So I just kind of wondered if that was different. But I also like that one of the things that you said earlier was about coping. And then you just said, whenever y'all are talking to the guys, it starts with their childhood. So I find that very interesting. It sounds like perhaps coping is something that we need to be starting to teach our children pretty young. Now, as far as going overseas and all of that stuff, I'm not sure how anybody can prepare for that. Right. But surely a strong foundation at home can't hurt.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that, when you talk about resiliency, I think a lot of that comes with, especially looking at now, like parents are so disconnected from children, and there's a lot of lack of parenting in the home, even in families where the husband and wife are staying intact, there's a very big disconnect in, you know, dual income families, and mom and dad's out working, and the children just don't get the life skills and the relationship building that's very important to a child's development. And then later on it comes out in life and they're just not equipped to deal with trauma. And we're all going to face trauma. Like, look, the military doesn't have a monopoly on trauma. Right. A lot of veterans think they do.
Right.
But I couldn't imagine, you know, a mom that lost her child to a drunk driver or some. I mean, there's trauma everywhere in life. If you're alive, life itself is traumatic, and you're going to face hardships. And I believe there's a million ways in this world to be hurt, but really only one way to get well. And I think that's through a relationship with God and understanding who you are and who you're created to be and how to live in accordance the way we were created to live. I believe that's the recipe for resiliency, and I believe that's the recipe for recovery. And when you talk about the military, like, I'm so thankful the military leadership recognizes that. Guys like General Nellett, a commandant of the Marine Corps, putting out a spiritual fitness plan in 2016 against the political opposition to that, and allowing the military to be given these lessons to prepare these warriors. Because, you know, there is a way to prepare and be stronger and more resilient to combat. It's going to be hard, and you're going to face things and see things you shouldn't see. But I mean, I look at my son Hunter right now, and I know, because I know who he is. He understands who he is. Mm-hmm. He has a very strong faith. And if he does, and you know, as a dad, I pray he has the boringest deployment ever. Yeah. But if he does see these things and witness these things, I believe it may affect him. But I have a very strong confidence that he has the ability to bounce back because of his relationship with God and understanding who he is.
Yeah.
From the time,
I believe that.
From the time that the soldier comes home, how long, it's kind of two questions, how long is it taking them to find an organization like Mighty Oaks, and how are they finding you? Because there's no help with the VA, or they can't refer them to you?
Right. That's a really good question, because, I mean, we have like probably unprecedented, I would say Mighty Oaks, and I'm not saying this because I'm the president of the organization, I'm extremely proud of it, but I believe we probably have the most access to active duty troops. But we're not even close to what we should. The way we get guys on, we actually get guys on official military orders to us. The command send them, but it has only been spread through word of mouth, like by command. So if someone came to our program before, if a commander is familiar with our program, and I have a very intentional effort of trying to, I mean, a lot of my travel is going to commands, briefing them, letting them know that we have a free resource to the commanders, and that way. So it's been just kind of personal networking. Now, the military as a whole, it just hasn't happened, particularly in the VA. The VA in 2008, there was what's called the Office of Faith-Based and Community Alternative Programs, and that was defunded. And, you know, you could do the math. It could be, you know, Obama. The Obama administration took over in 2008, but that program is defunded. And at that moment, everything in the VA went clinical. So if someone went into the VA for treatment for post-traumatic stress, they had one option, pills, counseling and pills. And that's how it's been dealt with since. I mean, we had the average guy we get to our program from the veteran community is on an average of over 20 pills a day for PTSD. And, you know, not being a medical conspiracist or anything, but I think we all know that you can't get well when you're on 20-something pills a day. You have to be able to feel. And while the body has this natural thing to, this natural process to protect itself and create these symptoms to protect itself, the body also has a very natural process by design to reacclimate and to heal by seeing that, hey, I drove through this intersection and I see a little red Corolla, and last time I seen a little red Corolla, it exploded and killed three of my friends. To be able to go through that and realize this car isn't dangerous, like I'm okay, and let your body actually reacclimates. The human body is absolutely incredible at healing itself, but it can't do that if those symptoms are numbed. And I kind of went off of your question, but
that's all right.
But I mean, the VA and the military as a whole needs to be able to present programs without making them government programs. Mighty Oaks is one example of many great organizations that are out there with real statistics. We've had almost 2,600 graduates from our program. We've had no suicides from any combat veterans that came through our program with PTSD. Wow. I mean, so we're, you know, batting 100%. No clinical programs can't claim that. I mean, we got guys killing themselves inside the VA to make a statement. The last guy last week that shot himself in the VA center in Austin, he told his girlfriend, like, I want to make a statement. I want to let them know that this program ain't working, so they'll take it seriously and help other veterans. Like, the faith-based programs do work. They have worked for a long time. I mean, look at the prison system, the recidivism rates of people that go through faith-based programs and people that don't. California, I think it's 77% recidivism. People going back to prison after they get out of the California prison system. The graduates of TUMI, which is the Urban Ministry Institute, that has a faith-based seminary, their graduates are 4%. So, I mean, faith-based programs are being used in prisons and all over, and these programs work. But for some reason, the VA, unless you have a clinician, at Oversight, they're not going to refer people to the program. And we don't want, for us, we don't want clinicians in our program. All of our instructors are peer-to-peer. They're guys that went through the program. They can relate. They can connect on a personal level. They can share their personal testimonies and help each other move along. And there's no stigma of someone. For example, we have flag officers. Like, we have the highest rank we've had come through is a colonel. Like, that colonel's not going to go ask for help for a clinician. He's going to lose his career. We have aviators that come through that are pilots. And if they ask for help and say they have an anxiety and depression, they're not going to be able to fly anymore. And so they need a place where they can go that is not clinical, that can get help in a comfortable environment, and it's not going to be repercussions for them. I mean, this is why I didn't get help until the wheels flew off. I had a top secret clearance. If I asked for help and go see a clinician, I may lose my job and not be able to do a job that I love and believe in anymore. And so there has to be alternative programs out there.
I'm going to encourage everybody to get the book, An Unfair Advantage. And I hear rumors about a movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Matter of fact, we have a guest in here, one of the producers,
yeah.
Nate Bobbitt from LD Entertainment.
Nate, peek in over here. Come on. Peek over here by Hot News Natalie.
Yeah.
Goodbye. Pink, tell us a little
bit. Cast member.
Talk into that microphone right there. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, we're excited.
Lean a little bit more to your right there. I want to get you right on that camera. There you go. Yeah, let's get close in here.
Totally excited about doing the movie about Chad and Kathy. Work for LD Entertainment. Done movies in the past. I can only imagine partly producers on that, and Risen a few years ago, and then we did Jackie the Gray and several others. Movie coming out next month called Biggest Little Farm. Go see it. It's awesome. So we just got excited about Chad and Kathy's story, and just think there's a real redemption story here, and that people need to hear, not only because of what happened to Chad and Kathy, but because of what they've done in their lives since then. It's one of those movies where you get into it and you realize, we can save lives by doing this movie. Yeah. If veterans and their families and girlfriends or boyfriends or whatever go see that movie, they're going to find a place where they can get help and they can get it for free.
Yeah.
And it'll save lives. You know, when 20-some a day are committing suicide, this is something we're passionate about to jump on board with. So we're excited to do it.
I'm excited about it. I'm praying for you guys. I'm praying for that project. I want you to know I'm praying for your son in Afghanistan.
Thank you.
Protection.
Thank you.
Angels all around him, hedges of protection. And just, I agree with you. I hope he has the most boring deployment.
Yeah. I told him that too. He's like, what? Why would you say that? Yeah. Yeah. Your dad. That's why I'd say that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I appreciate you, man. I appreciate your story. I can't stress it enough. This has become like something just clicked in me recently and just watching this stuff going on. And I'm like, this is going to be a personal pursuit and battle for me, and I'm telling you, I appreciate our warriors, but if you're a warrior, don't stop fighting. Keep on fighting. And you got people out there like Chad and his crew and Kathy who are willing to help you fight and come alongside you and fight. You know, this Mighty Oaks program, this foundation is incredible, and I'll remind you, mightyoaksprograms.org. It's a free 6-week intensive. I mean, you got it for men, you got it for women, and you say, well, how can they offer it for free? Well, it costs $2,500 to send one person through for the week-long thing. You need to go to Mighty Oaks Programs, because there's a lot of folks out there, you're not warriors, but you are patriots, and I'm calling on the patriots. Go out there, go to this website, you can donate $25. I will not let the sun go down on my life today without becoming a member and partnering with them to do this. You can donate $25 a month, become a partner with them, and I'm sure they'll take all any kind of donation you want to send in there. And there's folks out there who can do it. You know, we don't sit around asking you for money on most episodes, and we never really. I mean, you know, unless you go to watchchad.com buy a hat, but whatever. But I encourage people, do something with your money that matters, because you know, Jesus said, "Hey, I won't forget a cup of water that you give to one of these little ones." So you don't know what's going to wash on the shores of eternity by doing something like this. This guy's batting 1,000 with our warriors, and I'm telling you, Chad, I appreciate what you're doing. I know you're not in this thing for the fame, the glory, the notoriety, the books, the movies, all these things. It's a passion. It's a story, and it's a powerful one.
Yeah,
so
I
appreciate your vulnerability, because I've seen things, I've read things, and you know, I asked you before we got on here. I said, anything off limits? You said no. I said, well, you don't seem like an off limits kind of guy. So
no, I'm not.
So I encourage people, go get an unfair advantage. Go get it, Chad. I appreciate you. I love you. Appreciate. I'm happy
Thank
to.
You.
No, you partner with you, be friends, and all those good things. So I wish you nothing but the best. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me on, and thanks for spreading the word.
Yeah.
I'm confident today we'll save someone listening.
I believe so. Yeah. I agree. My lovely wife, Jade, party foul Steve. He's comatose. He's on some kind of drugs today. I don't even. He shot his wad in the other episode. It was all done. Hot News Natalie representing Colin Noir. Look at that shirt. Show that thing off. You're welcome, Colin. Yeah, I bought that. Don't ask why Natalie's wearing it. Puppet Master Mark, Candice, Queen of the Ethiopians. Go where podcasts are offered. Subscribe. Tell your friends. Rate, review. Give us a 5-star. We don't do 1-stars around here. You know why? Because we don't suck. We only do things in excellence, and you know that's true. And we want you to continue supporting us just by listening. I had a guy on Twitter who said, I'm sick of Chad Prather. All he does is he begs for money. And I'm like, podcasts are free, dummy.
But he might have been watching Reverend Swindle.
Yeah. Reverend Swindle does ask for a little bit of money. But anyway, well, there you go. But I love you guys. God bless you. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.